The second case for oral argument this morning is Elmer Wayne Zahn, Jr., the appellant versus the state of South Dakota, appellee. And for the appellant, we have Mr. Thomas Tobin from Aberdeen. And for the appellee, we have Mr. Frank Geegan, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Tobin, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Good morning, Chief Justice Gilbertson, Justices of the Supreme Court, clerks, and counsel. This case is a criminal case that stems out of Brown County. It involves a conviction on a drug conviction for possession of marijuana with the intent to distribute that marijuana. And today I wish to argue mainly two points in the case that I think are most relevant in the time period that we have. One is whether or not the warrant should have been issued by the magistrate regarding the contents of that application, which was the affidavit by the police officer. And the other one is the issue regarding the placement of the GPS unit on the defendant's car without his consent or his knowledge, and the resulting use of that information from the GPS unit. In this case, it's the relevant facts go back to June of 2008 when Mr. Zahn's wife died. They were not living together at that time. She actually died at her daughter's home, and since it was an unintended death, it was investigated by law enforcement and the coroner. At the scene of the daughter's apartment, actually, the officers found a suitcase, and inside the suitcase was over $8,000 in cash and several baggies in the suitcase. The officers took the money and took it and had they put it in a locker and had the drug dog come by and see if it would alert on the money, and it did. And the money was confiscated by law enforcement. Nothing else happens between June of 2008 and November of 2008. There was no further investigation of my client. My client was at the apartment when the police officers were there, but he was not there at the time of his wife's death. And they had not been living together. In November of 2008, my client was arrested by police officers in Brown County, and pursuant to that arrest, he was charged with DUI and possession of marijuana. At the time of that arrest and in the search of the vehicle, my client had in a compartment $10,000 in cash. And he also had a small amount of marijuana in the vehicle at that time. At that time, the law officers took the money and went through the same process of having the money put in lockers, having to see whether the drug dog would hit on it, which in this case was probably a given since the money and the marijuana were found together. And that was the end of that particular investigation, as it appeared, because nothing else was done regarding my client until March of 2009. And in the intervening time, the officer who did the affidavit in this case was also had been a member of the drug task force in northeastern Brown County. It involved the law enforcement officers from several different areas, Highway Patrol, the DCI, the local sheriff's office, police department, and during this period of time, he admitted that in none of their information that was received through the task force was my client's name mentioned as a possessor of marijuana or other drugs or a seller of any illicit substances or contraband. The reports that they got in did not list him as being present at different types of areas where drugs were being used. The informants did not do a controlled buy or attempt to do a controlled buy. There was no real personal observation of the defendant made during this intervening time. On March 3rd of 2009, the officers decided that they would place a GPS unit on my client's car. My client's car was parked in a off the street. It was not in a public street, but it was in a private parking lot that was open to the public. It was an apartment parking lot. And the officers went there in the early morning hours and attached a what we would call a GPS device. This is more than just a GPS device, and it's actually a part of a computer program that's available in which you can actually take the device and install it with certain types of antennas on the vehicle. And then there's a computer program that is tied to the device, and so whenever the car, whenever the vehicle moves, the program kicks on and it tracks all the movement of that vehicle wherever it goes 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And as this goes on, then the officers can go and look at the information on the computer inside that program for that particular unit, and it can track every movement, every place, down to 5 to 10 feet according to the officer, and it can track also how long any vehicle stays in any one given place.
Mr. Tobin, how far is its range, just out of curiosity? I know he went to Gettysburg, I think, but can it go farther out than that?
You know, I'm not aware of that, and didn't come out, and okay. And how far, it was, what the range was, but Gettysburg is about 100 miles away from Aberdeen, yeah. And so it would have quite an extensive range involving, you know, someone's daily activities. Also, during this period of time, from March 3rd, 2009, until the time that the investigation was somewhat concluded, a total period of 26 days went by, and so the device was on my client's car for 26 days, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all the way through, recording all the whereabouts.
Now, there was no, obviously there was no search warrant sought by the police to put this GPS tracking mechanism on. Would there have been enough probable cause for them to get a search warrant had this been, had they sought it?
I don't think there would have been at that time. At the time that they actually put the device on, it's, I don't know what took place for 4 months, but nothing as far as official investigation took place for 4 months. But I don't believe that there would have been enough evidence or enough information that would have been available to present to a court to get a search warrant, because they simply, in my estimation, they were simply fishing. I mean, they were simply seeing if this device would give them some evidence that could possibly go from there and then further their investigation.
Well, before we even ask the question whether you need a search warrant, don't we have to first ask the question whether putting a GPS device on a car is a search? Is it?
You know, hopefully we will get beyond the location or the act of putting the device on the vehicle. It's not the putting of the device on the vehicle that I think is critical in the analysis of the Fourth Amendment, or in our case, our state constitution. What I think is critical is what is received. The acquisition of information that the device allows someone to receive, that is what is really at issue here. The device itself, if you don't ever activate it, of course, it has no meaning. But if you activate it, now you have seized part of that vehicle. You have taken that vehicle into your own domain as to every location within 5 to 10 feet, as to every duration, as to every stop, 24 hours a day, and there's no purpose in what you're doing other than to fish for information.
But it cannot detect illegal versus legal conduct, correct?
That's correct, and it doesn't shut off versus private and public property either. The GPS, it's not specific as to who owns the property, what the property is used for. It just gives specific coordinates.
How is that different, though? That's why I ask, is it a search? How would that be any different, say, than having someone tail your client simply night and day, and make a notation of where your client goes, how long he's there, and so on and so forth?
The result could be the same. However, from a practical sense, we know that it's not practical to do that. And And
we're talking about the Fourth Amendment and what constitutes a search. Is it a search to simply track someone's movements night and day? Is that a search if those movements are all in the public domain?
No, I don't think that if a law officer wants to actually attempt to tail someone 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and keep notes on when he moves the car and where he goes and how long he stays there and then when it's moved again,
so
I don't think that's searching.
So why then is it different that the modern technology now gives the officer another tool to do essentially the same thing as putting a tail on the car?
Because that's the seizure part. That's because the information that is being obtained is not available. We know that it's okay to say that police officers could tail someone 24 hours a day and that they could do all these things as far as taking notes. We know in a practical sense, the success of that was probably not very good. In the one case we cited, in fact, that was one of the criteria that they used in determining whether or not the department was going to authorize a GPS unit, was whether or not they have failed to have been able to tail people and to do exactly what you are suggesting. Because in a practical sense, it's probably not possible.
So the Fourth Amendment analysis depends somewhat on how efficient the monitoring is?
I think the Fourth Amendment analysis actually gets back to what the public would expect to be free from. You know, it's. I think that the Fourth Amendment says that we're free from being invaded. We're free from being targeted. We're free from being subject to someone taking information from us without our knowledge, without our consent. And this information is not only usable in a criminal context, or it's not only usable in a criminal investigation against a particular subject. This information also will reveal much more about an individual, especially over a period of 23 days or 26 days or longer periods of time, and because it will reveal all who you associate with, all the contacts you make, and all the different types of business that you conduct on your own behalf.
Do you make any differentiation between whether the vehicle would go into an area considered private property or versus, say, in the parking lot at Northern? Or do you have the same problem no matter where the vehicle is?
There's two parts to that. One is if I went to private property for such as an apartment house complex.
Your garage.
Well, a garage would be different, I think, even though the amount of information that could be obtained just by the GPS tracking unit inside the garage itself would be limited. So therefore, if you take this and park it inside of my own garage, out of the sight of anyone, I don't think there's any really useful information that's being obtained because the car isn't moving. It's just recording how long you've actually been there. If you take it from the context of in a private property, then I think then it raises more issues because now you're tracking, now you're doing something that the police couldn't do unless the private property is viewable from a public street or that type of thing. But you certainly would have greater concerns if, in fact, the device could actually give more information than just location and duration inside of a public garage, a private garage. But I do think that's one facet that the courts have looked at.
All right, Mr. Tobin, you said you wanted to get beyond the property issue in the search, and the U.S. Supreme Court has done that in the Katz case, where it said that you have to look at whether or not there was a showing by a person of an expectation of privacy and whether or not it was a type of a protection that the public in general would look at. And that's where these cases really start getting fuzzy is under the Knotts case of whether or not if you're on the public road, you have a reasonable expectation of privacy there. How does this fit with the GPS? I think that's what we're going to struggle with in this case.
Let's just back up a second. Before you got to Katz, the Supreme Court of the United States dealt with electronic eavesdropping and it dealt with the advancement of technology. And initially, it said, well, you tap into a phone line, you're not really searching anything, you're not really looking into anything, you're not really taking any property, so therefore we're going to allow that. And then I think that they realized that, whoa, technology is going faster than we can go. Technology is going to get us in positions that we really don't want the public to go into. Because one analysis is the risk analysis. But then you get to COTS, and then in COTS they say, well, no, we can't focus on property, we can't focus on containers and that type of stuff. We have to look at what people expect it is private, and whether or not that expectation that they have would be something that the public would want to have enforced. And in this case, I believe that if you look out there, that everybody would expect that no police officer is going to attach a GPS unit to my car without my knowledge or consent.
But you know, the latest case that's discussed this, United States versus Walker, came down just this year in 2011. And the court observed that, indeed, the prevalence of GPS-enabled cellular telephones ensures that a great many Americans are walking around with this type of technology in their pockets and their handbags every day. So has it become, have we gotten to the point where it's now accepted that we are being, that this kind of technology is being used?
It's different.
That's what this goes.
Yeah, I understand it. But I think that what they're referring to is that I have GPS capability in my vehicle because I get lost a lot. And so I use it so I can kind of get to where I think I'm supposed to be going. But it doesn't. That GPS capability doesn't give me the opportunity to find out where you're at. And I think that's the difference, is that the general GPS technology tells me where I'm at and can direct me to where I want to go. But this GPS technology is combined with a computer program to where not only can it tell someone else where I'm at, but it can also tell me 24 hours, 7 days a week as to where I've been and how long I've been there and all the contacts that I've made and all the patterns of my life. And so I think it's gone beyond that. In reference to where we're going or what we are looking at is the fact that people are using technology in public areas a lot more. They are using technology to do texting. They're doing emails. They're doing phone conversations out in the public. Those used to be done in offices or in homes, that type of thing. Now it's being done on public streets and public buildings and public highways. And the technology is there to intercept those types of transmissions. The technology is there, even though there's no search, there's no, you know, nothing like this, they can actually have that technology to intercept those types of communications.
Say I own a trucking company and I want to know where all my trucks are, so I put these GPS devices on my trucks. If I can do that as a truck owner, why can't the police do it?
Because I think there's a big difference between someone who has a legitimate commercial interest in running his business and protecting his own property and protecting his own business versus what the police are doing or what they are capable of doing. If they are allowed to attach GPS devices onto my vehicle and find out a lot of things about my private life, there's a big difference between what the police ought to be doing. The other part is that in this particular case, the location of the GPS device and what it offered was the real tie-in to what the, from a geographical standpoint, as to what they used in the affidavit and the search warrant. But I really believe that we have to get beyond the issue of whether it was on private property or not, or how intrusive it is to attach these types of devices, because technology has gone beyond that. The real argument is, do people in South Dakota, do they have expectation that the police will not bug their vehicles? And if that is true, then is society ready to enforce that expectation of privacy? And I think that's where the argument comes down. There's also in the cases cited that talks about another way of saying it is the risk analysis. Are you willing to place this risk onto the public without any type of supervision whatsoever? And that's what we have here, is that the state wants to urge that the police have no restraints at all and obtaining information from the public by virtue of these types of electronic devices. They can drop them in your coat pocket when you check your coat. They can put them in your coat and then record conversations. I mean, it's all coming, and I think that the time to look at it is, why wouldn't society want the police to go to a neutral person, a magistrate or a judge, and have them evaluate whether or not the device should be placed in there or not? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tobin. Mr. Geegan, I'd like to start right out where Mr. Tobin left off. What's wrong with a officer having to go to a magistrate to get permission to put a GPS on? He's not asking for outright prohibition. I hear him saying you just simply need a judge's permission to do it.
Right, but in order for the warrant requirement to apply, there has to be Fourth Amendment implications. And the state would submit that in this particular case, there was simply none. If you look in the state's case, courts have held, can I quote, no warrant is required to install a GPS device unless Fourth Amendment rights would first have to be violated or implicated in order to install it. And the state would submit here that there's simply no expectation of privacy in the defendant's vehicle, and specifically with regard to its movement upon a public highway.
What about if they dropped it in the coat pocket, like he suggested?
Again, as long as...
Find your person. Don't you think there's some expectation of privacy there?
As long as what you're monitoring is travel on a public thoroughfare or a public street, the individual would have no expectation of privacy. There's no difference in using a GPS device versus visual observation.
But how do you shut it off? I mean, it monitors everything.
It only monitors movement on a public street.
Well, Justice Meyer Henry's purse is in the back room. What if somebody came in, because we're out here, put a GPS device in her purse? Is that okay without a warrant?
Yes. Because, like I said, what it's monitoring is only her movements.
All right. What about tapping into all of our cell phones? Probably three-fourths of us here have cell phones or more that have GPS unit in it.
Right. But there's a huge difference between tapping into the telephone and actually eavesdropping on private conversations.
I'm not talking about conversation. I'm talking about the GPS unit in it that tracks our movement. Can the police tap into that technology in anyone's cell phone and track everyone in here wherever they go for extended periods of time?
Again, with all due respect to the court, I guess the state would ask that we confine the argument to the facts of this particular case and leave that issue to the
Well, you're asking for broad authority, and we have to look at where it's going to go.
What the state is insisting is that in this particular case, since the GPS device only monitored the defendant's movements on a public highway, in which he had absolutely no expectation of privacy whatsoever, there was no Fourth Amendment violation.
But, you know, there is other courts. Some of the recent courts have not agreed with that. This really goes back to Knotts, which said there is no expectation of privacy for movement on highways. But in Maynard, which was just decided in 2010, the D.C. Circuit, you know, the court made an interesting observation that I'd like you to respond to. The court said the whole of one's movement over the course of a month is not constructively exposed to the public, because like a rap sheet, that whole reveals far more than the individual movements that are involved. I mean, isn't that just a true statement?
It may be, but if you look at the cases cited to in the state's brief, again, the information recorded by the GPS device provided no more information to police than what they could obtain had they simply assigned a patrol unit outside the defendant's residence and monitored his whereabouts via visual observation.
But does anybody expect that every single movement that they do over a prolonged period of time, because it seems like the cases that go against you focus on the prolonged period of surveillance. Does anyone really expect that kind of prolonged?
I guess the difficulty with that analysis is then where do you draw the line? Is it a week, 2 weeks permissible versus, say, maybe 20 days, 30 days? Again, I think the state would submit that the dispositive factor is, again, the fact that the individual in question has no expectation of privacy with regard to his movements in the public street.
All right. United States Supreme Court in Knox, there was a caveat, a reservation in that decision saying, well, if technology reaches the point that we have the type of dragnet, is the word they used, observation, then we'll have to deal with that in the future. Aren't we there?
No, absolutely not. Again, the state would stress that there would be no Fourth Amendment violation allegation in this particular case. Like I indicated earlier, they had law enforcement simply sign a unit outside the defendant's residence. Once again, a GPS device provided no more information than what they could have obtained.
Well, then what does that clause mean in Knox?
I guess other cases interpreting Knox have also stressed that you can't equate police efficiency with unconstitutionality. The courts have specifically said nothing in the Fourth Amendment prohibits the police from augmenting the sensory faculties bestowed upon them at birth, i.e. sight and sound, with whatever enhancements science and technology afford them. Courts have been specific and said that it has long been established that sensory enhancement devices, to the extent they do not reveal more than what could have been observed by the naked eye, are permissible. The courts have rejected the notion that visual observation becomes unconstitutional merely because police choose to use a more cost-effective mechanical eye than actual 24/7 visual surveillance.
Don't we have the problem of, since there's no absolute supervision about surveillance, the police can decide to put a GPS device on anyone or everyone's car and surveil everyone. And there's absolutely no Fourth Amendment implication, according to you, and yet we reach a society that becomes Orwellian. Everybody's movements are tracked all the time.
But again, those
just as Zinner says, those trackings tell stories. What doctors you go to, where you shop, who you visit.
But those aren't the facts presently before the court. Here, the law enforcement had specific reasonable suspicion to believe that the defendant was engaged
in
traffic of
narcotics. In their opinion, they had reasonable. But you're not even arguing that they needed that. You're saying they could have put the GPS device on the car without any suspicion.
Right, absolutely, because an individual has no expectation of privacy regarding the exterior of his car. The United States Supreme Court has made clear, and I quote, a person has a lesser expectation of privacy in a motor vehicle because its function is transportation, and it seldom serves as one residence or the repository of personal effects. A car, therefore, has little capacity for escaping public scrutiny. It travels on public thoroughfares where both its occupants and its contents are in plain view. Now, this court, on multiple occasions, has also specifically recognized the reduced or diminished expectation of privacy one has in an automobile.
But isn't the difference is the information that's gathered, not so much the movement as the information that's gathered and used. That's what the
again, specifically
is.
The information gathered in this particular case was no more than, again, the defendant's movements while traveling on a public highway. The state would submit that with the defendant voluntarily exposed to the public, he has no expectation of privacy.
Can the officers enter into private property that's fenced in or a garage and put a GPS device in there?
No, in those particular cases, there would be an expectation of privacy if the Fourth Amendment would be implicated. Here, the defendant's vehicle at the time in question was located in the parking lot of the apartment complex. Information obtained by police established that the defendant didn't live there, nor did he use that as his residing address. More importantly, the facts indicate that at the time in question, the vehicle was parked no more than 5 feet from a public sidewalk. The defendant made no attempt whatsoever to shield his vehicle from anybody who happened to pass by the parking lot. The police did not have to cross any fence or barrier in order to access the vehicle. The parking lot had no special features which would have prohibited somebody from standing in the street, accessing the parking lot, thereby have ready access to the vehicle. The state would rely on the arguments of...
I'm going to ask once more, okay, in Knotts, and I'll read part of it. If such dragnet-type police enforcement practices as Knox envisioned should ever eventually occur, there will be time enough to then determine whether constitutional principles may be applicable. And this decision was 20-some years ago. Technology has vastly expanded since then. What does this clause mean?
Right, but this particular case isn't a dragnet type of situation.
Okay.
Again, police had reasonable suspicion based on information set out in Detective Johnell's affidavit.
Okay, well,
that the detective was engaged in drug trafficking.
Well, you've never talked about reasonable suspicion before today, have you?
Well, I guess the point is, I guess it goes hand in hand with the information that was contained in the affidavit in support of the application for search.
Oh, wait a minute. You're one step beyond that. We're talking about when they attached it.
Right. At the time they attached it, they had information regarding the defendant's rather extensive criminal history involving narcotics.
All right. Are you saying that we have to apply some standard or test as to what their reasonable expectation would be or what their reasonable information would be?
I guess in this particular case, the police owner not only had reasonable suspicion, but again, when they attached the device based on the area in which it was located, it was reasonable for them to believe there was no expectation of privacy that the defendant had in that vehicle.
So are you suggesting that they should have reasonable suspicion then before they ever attach a GPS?
No.
Okay.
Again, order to require a warrant and reasonable suspicion, again, you have to implicate Fourth Amendment concerns. And the state would submit that this particular case was absolutely not. The vehicle was parked in a public parking lot.
So is there any limitation on the police attaching a GPS to anyone's vehicle?
As long as it doesn't implicate Fourth Amendment concerns. Again, it would depend upon where the vehicle was located at the time.
Parked out in the parking lot here. Is there any limitation on them attaching GPS unit to everyone who's in this room today?
No, there's no expectation of privacy in a vehicle parked in the parking lot and the track and movements upon a public highway.
And so how long can they leave it on there? Forever?
The cases have looked at and relied on haven't set any definitive guidelines. Like I said earlier, the difficulty is, okay, at what point do you draw the line? I mean, 10 days versus 2 weeks, anything over 2 weeks is impermissible. Again, the fact remains that the movement on a public highway, there's no expectation of privacy. The defendant's knowing and exposing that to anybody who happens occasionally to look.
But you keep going back to Knotts. I mean, that's the basis for Knotts. It seems to me that you're really not acknowledging the change in technology. You know, the Supreme Court, I know it's in the context of a house search, But in Kylo, they recognized the change in technology by using a heat sensor to look into someone's home.
Right, heat sensor because movements in a house are much more private than movements on a public highway.
But my point is, they're looking at changing technology. And isn't that, it seems to me that's what you're overlooking in your argument today, that this GPS is far different than the beeper that was used.
Right, it may be far beeper, but again, what the state would stress, okay, as indicated in the cases set forth in this brief, those courts have found, and I quote, the Fourth Amendment cannot sensibly and should not be read to mean that police should be no more effective in the 21st century than they were in the 18th century. The state would submit, again, that the courts have refused to equate police efficiency with unconstitutionality. The state would submit that the key in this particular case.
But that's what they did in Kyle. It was more efficient to use a heat sensor than actually peeking in the windows.
Right, but the distinguishing factor there, again, is the privacy one has regarding the movements within their dwelling. Here are the movements in question on a public street. Police officers, as well as anybody else, could easily monitor defendant's activities and whereabouts. Which street he was traveling on.
Once you attach it, it follows them wherever they are, private or public streets.
Right, but there would be no difference. I mean, if this law enforcement could simply, again, physically follow the defendant's movement in a patrol car, and once they, say, arrive at a private residence, law enforcement could park on a public street.
All right, what happens when I go into my garage? Can you follow me into, could a police officer follow me into my garage?
He can't follow you on your garage, but there's nothing I don't believe that would prevent him from sitting on a street outside your residence.
Okay, but the GPS goes into my garage.
But again, I guess the state will look at the privacy implications with regard to the vehicle that's stationed in your garage.
My garage is private. He can't come in there, can he?
Right, but again, I mean, all it's doing is tracking your movements and your ultimate destination.
And it's tracking non-movement as well. It's tracking how long that car's in the garage.
Exactly. But again, the state would simply stress, again, what we're talking about, again, is public movements. Okay, the device simply, once you park the car's parked in the public garage, the device deactivates. It simply shows its location.
All right. It also tracks speed. Can he issue speeding tickets based on how fast my vehicle is going and downloading the information over a month to see if I
went over?
I
don't believe that information is in present record as far as the GPS's capability, as far as, you know, establishing speed versus just mere location and whereabouts. Again, the state would submit, like I said, had the police station themselves outside the defendant's residence and monitors his travel on a public highway. There's no question there'd be no Fourth Amendment concern. The state would submit the end result doesn't change simply because the state resorted to the use of much more convenient, but of course referred to as a mechanical eye. It's simply a much more convenient method of monitoring the defendant's whereabouts.
Is there any guarantee that this information obtained by law enforcement won't be intentionally or unintentionally released to third parties who are private?
There's no indication in the record that that information would be disclosed to anyone outside specific law enforcement purposes.
Say somebody's getting divorced, can the other party subpoena the police records as to where the other spouse has been?
Possible. I guess at that point in time, the state could probably argue your confidentiality of those records, and under what circumstances would the court order that it be disclosed?
But once you say that, then you're suggesting that there's a privacy interest in the activity.
Again, depending upon the use of what's entailed. Stay very quickly, we'd like to move on specifically with regard to the other issues regarding the sufficiency of the affidavit in support of the search warrant. The defendant argues that there was nothing in the record which would link the storage unit to any criminal activity, specifically the presence of narcotics or contraband. The state would submit that the standard review in this case, unlike other cases, is not de novo. This court must give great deference to the lower court's determination of probable cause. The court must therefore draw every reasonable inference in support of the lower court's finding of probable cause. The state would submit that in that regard, the defense counsel, when questioning Detective John Dahl, readily admitted, and I quote, "The last three pages of your affidavit are full of things that, based on your training and experience, make you believe that you're going to find narcotics and drugs if you're actually able to look for them." The state would submit that if you look at Detective Journal's affidavit, it contains several pages setting out specific facts, detailing the need of requirement for a search warrant. As set out in the affidavit, and they indicated earlier, the defendant had a rather lengthy criminal history in regards to narcotics. He had repeated arrests for possession of marijuana as well as drug paraphernalia.
Wasn't there a lot of time, though, that had passed between, and some of those are pretty old. Even in the affidavit, some of the old, how many years before had
right.
that been a problem?
But the affidavit also specifically references the most recent incident in November of 2008, where the defendant was arrested for driving while under the influence.
And had the small amount of marijuana.
Small amount of marijuana.
Is that close enough, and is that enough?
Small amount of marijuana, and in addition to which the police seized a rather sizable amount of cash, one in excess of $10,000 from the vehicle.
And that was how long before this affidavit was submitted?
That incident took place in November of 2008, and the affidavit, the search warrant was issued on March 29th, 2009.
So it's 4 months or more.
And even more recent than the arrest in 2008 for driving while under the influence, the defendant, while on bond on that arrest, traveled and left Brown County and went to Gettysburg. When he was later arrested for violating the conditions of his bond, police again found a rascal-sized amount of cash on his person in excess of $2,000. The drug dog, as before, was asked to run and hit on the money. The state would submit the defense assertion that there was nothing to connect the storage units with illegal activity ignores the testimony given by police officers, and I quote, "The use of a storage locker typically signifies a person that is involved with a much higher quantity of drugs. According to the testimony presented, people keep it in a storage unit in order to avoid detection in the event that the search is later conducted at the residence." You know, unless there are any further questions from the court, the state would respectfully close by asking that the judgment conviction be affirmed in all respects.
Thank you, Mr. Gagan. Mr. Tobin, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I think it is important to go back and look at Knox, because Knox gets so many headlines in these cases, and it's a starting point for everything. But let's look at Knox. This is one of the most elementary type of things that there was. First of all, it wasn't placed in the vehicle. It was placed in a 5-gallon drum that the person that had the vehicle was going to take and possess and put it in his own car. Two, it was for one small trip. They were going to tail him from the point of picking up the drum to his residence or to some place where he was going to stop. But it was for less than a day. It was just for a very few hours, if that, a very short period of time. And all it was a beeper that required, in order for it to be successful, for the police to actually follow. The beeper itself wasn't giving any information. But the police had to follow. In that case, they actually lost the vehicle. They actually found the vehicle. And then they actually went and found the person at a particular point. We are light years ahead of where that was at. We're way ahead of that. And we're not even in the same, when you talk about 3G networks or 2G networks, that wasn't even in G network. And now we're into the 4 and 5G networks dealing with this issue. Now, look at one thing that was said about, okay, they can enhance all their normal senses and this type of stuff. Well, if you're having a conversation on a street, why can't I stand next to you and listen to it? However, so that you don't get suspicious that I am listening to your conversation and you don't think I am snooping, why don't I just put a electronic device in your pocket, in your coat pocket, and I'll stand 2 blocks away or I'll stand a mile away and listen to it. See, there's no end to this, and all we're saying is that what the public would expect is for some type of judicial passing on what is going to happen. The floodgates, or the dragnet, as they said, is there. I mean, that's exactly what's going on. And Justice Stevenson, you're right. It's that the Knox court said, you know, we're really only deciding a little tiny deal here. We don't know where technology is going to go, but if it ever gets more sophisticated than this, we're going to have to look at it. And that's what I think is being done today, is that we are looking at that. In this case, we're talking 23 days. And Justice Meyer Hinton is right in that we're talking about a time delay of over 4 months between actually longer than that. It actually goes from June of 08 until 11 of 08, 5 months, from the time that they first got some information about cash with his wife, and then the DUI arrest, and then they install the GPS unit 4 months later. You know, where does this stop? Is this to further an investigation where there are known facts and there's a known outcome and there's limitations on how long it's going to be in the vehicle? Is the magistrate or the court would be able to decide those types of issues as to what's reasonable under the circumstances that are being presented to it. But we won't know. And Chief Justice Gilbertson is right. In divorce cases, mental health cases, AIDS cases, cancer cases, what is the limit? Why would we give this type of authority to police officers with no restrictions when we have a state law that says private people can't do it? But the information, how are they going to keep the information private? There isn't any requirement that they do. There's nothing that would prohibit access in the public sector, those things that we talked about, and some even, you know, more scandalous things, the strip clubs and girlfriends' places and these types of things. Everything is a pattern, and all this information is being gathered, not knowing what's going to happen. In this particular case, it was the beginning of their investigation. This is while they got the evidence. They had nothing. One other point I want to make is that in the affidavit, the GPS coordinates are known. Unit 12, Unit 18, those exact coordinates are known on the GPS system. And within 5 to 10 feet, they are absolutely known. There's nothing to indicate that the GPS was ever at any of those coordinates because we don't know what those coordinates are. We don't have any idea as to Because most of the information in the search warrant deals with that they were nearby, or they were close to, or that they were sitting there next to the whole overall storage unit facility. But for some reason, there's nothing to indicate this, that the exact units were being accessed by anybody, or especially my client. The other thing is that when they had the opportunity, if you want to look at inferences, the officer testified they had clear shoe marks going in and out of this, the one in which the drugs were found. Why wouldn't they have taken pictures of the shoe marks? My guy's in jail. They could easily, and they don't wear their shoes in jail, their own shoes, they could have easily looked at the length of the shoe, the width of the shoe, and the tread of the shoe, and compared them and provided that evidence to the magistrate, which would have been additional evidence that would have tied my client, perhaps, exactly to that particular locker. It was known that at the time that they applied for the search warrant that the storage unit was actually rented by my client's brother. And until that time of the GPS and the additional search that happened, they had no indication as to what interaction or what role my client had in his brother's unit. They had none. The shoe would have given them some evidence, at least something that would have tied my guy specifically to that unit. But why wouldn't they have done that? Is it the inference that they didn't do it because it didn't fit? Is it the inference that they didn't do a plaster cast, they didn't do the photographs, they didn't do the measuring, they didn't do the observation of the tread of the shoe because, in fact, it didn't fit it? You can say there were footprints in there, but you had an absolute easy case to go and tie them together. But it never happened in this case. Can the police, can the government, with no restrictions and absolutely no requirement that anybody else know or pass on the wisdom of doing it, have unfettered right to go out and track me, track you, track anybody you want for any length of time that they want, and have no regulations as to the use of the information once it's obtained? Not every criminal investigation results in a charge. However, information obtained in a criminal investigation can be very damaging to private citizens who are not charged, or to private citizens. Or they can use the information of the tracking device to use that to what I would call squeezing other people to give information because they have this information that is damaged to them personally, not criminally, but personally. And we will never know about it. I think it's better justice that someone passes on this ahead of time, and the police can still do perhaps what they want to do if they go in front of the magistrate or the judge. And if he says no, then they shouldn't be doing it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tobin. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.